Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is Louisiana v. Calais, docket number 2429, decided April 29, 2026. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. These cases concern whether Louisiana's new congressional map is an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. After the 2020 census, a federal court held that Louisiana's congressional map likely violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act because it did not include a second majority minority district. When the state drew a new map that did include such a district, that new map was in turn challenged as an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. The questions presented were, first, did the lower court err in finding that race predominated in the legislature's enactment of the new map? Second, did the lower court err in finding that the new map fails strict scrutiny? Third, did the lower court err in subjecting the new map to the jingles preconditions? Fourth, is this action non-justiciable? On reargument, the parties were also directed to address whether the state's intentional creation of a second majority minority congressional district violates the 14th or 15th Amendments to the United States Constitution. The court held, because the Voting Rights Act did not require Louisiana to create an additional majority minority district, no compelling interest justified the state's use of race in creating the new map, and that map is an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of the court, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion, joined by Justice Gorsuch. Justice Kagan filed a dissenting opinion, joined by Justices Sotomayor and Jackson. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. Please remember, this is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. One final note. During the reading, you may hear glitches. Please know we are aware of the glitches and are working to improve over time. The following is the opinion of the court in Louisiana v. Calais.
Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, 52 United States Code, Section 10,301 and following, was designed to enforce the Constitution, not collide with it. Unfortunately, lower courts have sometimes applied this court's Section 2 precedents in a way that forces states to engage in the very race-based discrimination that the Constitution forbids. This tension between Section 2 and the Constitution came to a head when Louisiana redrew its congressional districts after the 2020 census. In 2022, a federal judge in the Middle District of Louisiana held that the map adopted by the state legislature likely violated Section 2 because it did not include an additional majority black district. But when the state drew a new map that contained such a district, its new map was challenged as a racial gerrymander. A three-judge court in the Western District of Louisiana held that the new map violated the Equal Protection Clause, and the state appealed to this court. The parties originally briefed and argued this suit last term, and their arguments at that time highlighted problems in the existing body of Section 2 case law. One problem resulted from the rule that in racial gerrymandering cases, unlike other cases involving claims of racial discrimination, see, for example, Arlington Heights v. Metropolitan Housing Development Corporation, decided in 1977, strict scrutiny is triggered only if race predominated in the state's decision-making process. In this suit, Louisiana adopted the challenged map and created the second majority black district because it quite reasonably anticipated that, if it did not do so, the Middle District of Louisiana would order the use of a map with a differently configured second majority black district that would effectively oust an incumbent whom the legislature sought to protect. Under our existing case law, that situation posed the question whether race or politics was the state's predominant motivation. Another problem stemmed from the long unresolved question whether compliance with the Voting Rights Act provides a compelling reason that may justify the intentional use of race in drawing legislative districts. For over 30 years, we have assumed, for the sake of argument, that the answer is yes. And we have gone further and assumed that it is enough if a state has a strong basis in evidence for thinking that the Voting Rights Act requires race-based conduct. See Cooper v. Harris, decided in 2017. But allowing race to play any part in government decision-making represents a departure from the constitutional rule that applies in almost every other context. These and other problems convinced us that the time had come to resolve whether compliance with the Voting Rights Act can indeed provide a compelling reason for race-based districting. We now answer that question. Compliance with Section 2, as properly construed, can provide such a reason. Correctly understood, Section 2 does not impose liability at odds with the Constitution, and it should not have imposed liability on Louisiana for its 2022 map. Compliance with Section 2 thus could not justify the state's use of race-based redistricting here. The state's attempt to satisfy the Middle District's ruling, although understandable, was an unconstitutional racial gerrymander, and we therefore affirm the decision below. Ratified in 1870, the 15th Amendment provides that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. For many years afterward, however, states heavily suppressed the right of black citizens to vote. See Brnovich v. Democratic National Committee, decided in 2021. States employed a variety of notorious methods, including poll taxes, literacy tests, property qualifications, white primaries, and grandfather clauses in a blatant effort to suppress black voting. Even as late as the mid-1960s, black registration and voting rates in some states were appallingly low. See South Carolina v. Katzenbach, decided in 1966. In addition, states employed legislative districting schemes to prevent the election of black candidates and candidates that black voters preferred. See Alexander v. South Carolina State Conference of the NAACP, decided in 2024, and Gumillion v. Lightfoot, decided in 1960. Section 2 of the 15th Amendment authorizes Congress to enact appropriate legislation to enforce the amendment's protections, and in 1965, Congress invoked that power to enact the Voting Rights Act. The Act and its amendments in the 1970s specifically forbade some of the practices that had been used to suppress black voting, including literacy tests and poll taxes. See 52 United States Code, Section 10,301. Prohibiting the denial of the right to vote in any election for failure to pass a test demonstrating literacy, educational achievement, or knowledge of any particular subject, or good moral character. We upheld many of these provisions in Katzenbach. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act in its original form closely tracked the language of the amendment it was adopted to enforce. At that time, Section 2 stated simply that no voting qualification or prerequisite to voting or standard, practice, or procedure shall be imposed or applied by any state or political subdivision to deny or abridge the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race or color. In Mobile v. Bolden, decided in 1980, the court interpreted this language, and four justices concluded in a plurality opinion that facially neutral voting practices violate Section 2 only if motivated by a discriminatory purpose. Justice Stevens, who concurred in the judgment, proposed a different but similarly demanding standard. See Bolden. Indeed, in his view, a districting practice, even if motivated in part by race, would not violate Section 2 so long as it was supported by valid and articulable justifications. Bolden roused an avalanche of criticism, both in the media and within the civil rights community. Allen v. Milligan decided in 2023. Critics argued that a focus on discriminatory intent rather than discriminatory effects would defeat worthy claims because of the difficulty of proving intentional discrimination. Members of Congress evidently shared these concerns. In 1982, shortly after Bolden, Congress sought to abrogate that decision by amending Section 2. A House bill was originally passed under a loose understanding that Section 2 would prohibit all discriminatory effects of voting practices and that intent would be irrelevant, but this version met stiff resistance in the Senate. Mississippi Republican Executive Committee v. Brooks decided in 1984. Critics worried that an effects test would lead to mandatory racial proportionality in elections, a scenario regarded by many as intolerable. The House and Senate eventually compromised, and the final product included both an effects test in Section 2A and a robust disclaimer against proportionality in Section 2B. This latter provision also specifies what a plaintiff must establish to prove a Section 2 violation. The provision requires consideration of the totality of circumstances in each case and demands proof that the political processes leading to nomination or election in the state or political subdivision are not equally open to participation by members of a protected class, in that its members have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. 52 United States Code, Section 10301B. Congress took this language almost verbatim from Justice White's opinion for the court in White v. Register, decided in 1973, which involved a vote dilution claim, that is, a claim that a districting scheme impermissibly lessens the weight of the votes of minority voters. In White, the court affirmed a judgment that Texas had used two multi-member electoral districts invidiously to cancel out or minimize the voting strength of racial groups. According to White, a vote dilution plaintiff had to show that the political processes leading to nomination and election were not equally open to participation by the group in question, that its members had less opportunity than did other residents in the district to participate in the political processes and to elect legislators of their choice. The decision in White did not say anything one way or another about proof of discriminatory purpose or intent, but the court's rationale rested on evidence that gave rise to an obvious inference that the state had set out to prevent the election of candidates preferred by minority voters. The Texas districting scheme generally used single-member districts but employed multi-member districts but employed multi-member districts in two parts of the state where single-member districts might have resulted in the election of minority candidates. The court observed that the use of multi-member districts is not necessarily or per se unconstitutional, but it recognized that such districts can be employed to achieve discriminatory ends. See also Perkins v. Matthews, decided in 1971, observing that a switch to at-large elections could be a method to maintain white control of the political process. Allen v. State Board of Elections, decided in 1969, explained that a change to at-large voting could nullify the ability of minority voters to elect their candidate of choice. The court also cited strong evidence that the legislature had done so in the case at hand. Writing at a time when the Democratic Party was dominant in much of Texas, the court noted that a white-dominated organization which had effective control over candidate slating within that party had engaged in racial campaign tactics in white precincts to defeat candidates who had the overwhelming support of the black community, thereby effectively excluding the black community from participation in the Democratic primary selection process. The court likewise cited evidence that the legislature had invidiously excluded Mexican Americans from effective participation in political life, specifically in the election of representatives to the Texas House of Representatives. Thus, White presented a situation in which circumstantial evidence suggested very strongly that the state had created multi-member districts for the purpose of diluting minority votes. A few years later, when Congress looked for language that would abrogate Mobile v. Bolden's interpretation of Section 2, it selected terms that were nearly identical to language used in White. The accompanying report of the Senate Judiciary Committee explained that the amendment's purpose was to repudiate Bolden and establish a new vote dilution test based on White. This court first construed the amended version of Section 2 in Thornburg v. Jingles. Jingles concerned a challenge to North Carolina's multi-member districting scheme on the ground that it diluted the vote of black citizens. Jingles was decided at a time when this court often paid insufficient attention to the language of statutory provisions, and Justice Brennan's opinion for the court followed this pattern. Instead of analyzing what the statute said, the opinion quoted the text of amended Section 2 and then jumped to the Senate Judiciary Committee report. Relying heavily on that report, the opinion set out three threshold requirements for proving a Section 2 vote dilution claim, plus a non-exhaustive list of factors to be considered in making a final decision as to whether the state had violated Section 2. To succeed in proving a Section 2 violation, Jingles taught a plaintiff must make four showings. First, the plaintiff must make four showings. First, the plaintiff must show that the minority group in question is sufficiently large and geographically compact to constitute a majority in a reasonably configured district. Wisconsin Legislature v. Wisconsin Elections Commission decided in 2022 per curiam. A district is reasonably configured, we later explained, if it comports with traditional districting criteria, such as being contiguous and reasonably compact. Second, the minority group must be able to show that it is politically cohesive. Third, the minority must be able to demonstrate that the white majority votes sufficiently as a bloc to enable it to defeat the minority's preferred candidate. Finally, a plaintiff who demonstrates the three preconditions must also show, based on the totality of circumstances, that the political process is not equally open to minority voters. In later cases, redistricting plans that states created to comply with the Voting Rights Act were themselves challenged as racial gerrymanders. This court approached such cases by building on the framework from other racial discrimination cases under the Equal Protection Clause. In those cases, if race played a role in a decision made by a government actor, strict scrutiny applied. Under this standard, the government needed to assert a compelling interest that justified its use of race, and if the analysis progressed beyond this point, the government had to show that its use of race was narrowly tailored to vindicate that interest. See, for example, Students for Fair Admissions, Incorporated v. President and Fellows of Harvard College, decided in 2023. The court modified this framework for racial gerrymandering cases. Although any use of race in government decision-making generally triggers strict scrutiny, in gerrymandering cases, a challenger must show that race was the government's predominant consideration. See Bush v. Vera, decided in 1996. And in cases where race predominated, states would sometimes assert that compliance with the Voting Rights Act provided a compelling interest justifying the use of race. Yet we never decided whether compliance with the Act could constitute a compelling interest. Instead, we repeatedly assumed without deciding that the Voting Rights Act could constitute a compelling interest because in all those cases, the Act actually did not demand the state's race-predominant districting. Thus, the states in those cases could not satisfy strict scrutiny regardless of whether compliance with the Voting Rights Act could provide a compelling interest. The first case in which the court explicitly made this assumption was Miller v. Johnson, decided in 1995, which concerned a majority black district that was designed to satisfy the Justice Department's preclearance demands under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. The Miller court first found that the legislature had subordinated traditional race-neutral districting principles, including but not limited to compactness, contiguity, and respect for political subdivisions or communities defined by actual shared interests, to racial considerations. For this reason, the court held, race had predominated in the creation of the new district, and the state had to demonstrate that its districting legislation was narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling interest. The court declined to address whether or not, in some cases, compliance with the Voting Rights Act standing alone could provide a compelling interest independent of any interest in remedying past discrimination. Instead, the court explained that the challenged district was not reasonably necessary under a constitutional reading and application of the Voting Rights Act. So the state's goal of complying with the Act could not supply a compelling interest. We repeated much the same analysis in Shaw v. Hunt, decided in 1996, applying strict scrutiny to a redistricting plan that a state crafted to comply with both Section 2 and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Once again, we did not reach the question expressly left open in Miller, whether the Voting Rights Act could itself provide a compelling interest to justify race-predominant districting. After assuming, arguendo, for the purpose of resolving this suit, that compliance with Section 2 could be a compelling interest, we held that the plan failed strict scrutiny because it was not reasonably required under a constitutional reading and application of the Voting Rights Act. Likewise, in Alabama Legislative Black Caucus v. Alabama, decided in 2015, we applied strict scrutiny to a race-predominant districting plan that the state had created for two purposes. First, to come close to a one-person, one-vote ideal, and second, to ensure compliance with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. We held that, even if the Voting Rights Act could provide a compelling interest, the map did not satisfy strict scrutiny because it was not required by the Act. Once again, we left open whether compliance with the Act remained a compelling interest. In Cooper, we continued our long-standing assumption that complying with the Voting Rights Act is a compelling interest. Again, we did not need to resolve this question because a constitutional reading and application of the Act did not require the district at issue. And again, in Wisconsin legislature, we once more assumed that complying with the Voting Rights Act is a compelling interest. But because the Wisconsin Supreme Court had not properly analyzed whether the Act required the map at issue, we remanded for the court to undertake a full strict scrutiny analysis. This was the legal framework in place when the lawsuits involving Louisiana's congressional districts were filed and litigated in the lower courts. As noted earlier, the underlying litigation in this suit resulted from Louisiana's response to the population changes disclosed by the 2020 census. The subsequent reapportionment of House seats among the states left Louisiana with the same number of seats, 6, that it had previously been allocated, but due to shifts in population, the state needed to recalibrate its districts. In 2022, Louisiana enacted a new map, House Bill 1, that closely resembled its immediate predecessor. House Bill 1, like its predecessor, included only one district in which black voters were a majority of the voting age population. As soon as House Bill 1 was enacted, lawsuits were filed in the Middle District of Louisiana asserting that the map violated the Voting Rights Act by packing large numbers of black voters into a single majority black district and cracking the remaining black voters among the other five districts. Robinson v. Ardoin, 2022. After the suit was filed, the Robinson Court issued a lengthy opinion concluding that House Bill 1 likely violated the Voting Rights Act by failing to include a second majority black district. The court thus entered a preliminary injunction requiring Louisiana to implement a new map before the 2022 election, which was less than 6 months away. Louisiana objected to the decision and promptly appealed. But because of circumstances outside the state's control, its appeal ended up in limbo. This court granted certiorari before judgment and held the case pending a decision in Allen. Nearly a year later, after deciding Allen, the court dismissed the petition as improvidently granted and remanded the case to the Fifth Circuit to consider Louisiana's appeal in the ordinary course. By that time, the 2023 election had passed, and the urgency that had justified the preliminary injunction was no longer present. In a tentatively worded opinion, the Fifth Circuit held that the Robinson District Court's decision was valid when it was issued, but that the preliminary injunction was no longer needed. Robinson v. Ardoin, decided in 2023. In the absence of urgency, the Fifth Circuit remanded the case to the District Court with instructions to give Louisiana time to draw a new map. If Louisiana failed to do so, the Fifth Circuit suggested, the district court could proceed with a trial on the merits and, if needed, remedial proceedings. After the Fifth Circuit's remand, Louisiana did not have many options. In the Robinson decision, the district court held that the plaintiffs were likely to prevail on their claim that the Voting Rights Act demanded the creation of a second majority black district. So if Louisiana refused to adopt such a map, the district court would likely draw one and mandate its use. Wishing to avoid that outcome, Louisiana decided to draw its own map. After a deliberative process, Louisiana decided to draw its own map. After a deliberative process, NOUPT 8, Senate Bill 8 retains the original majority-minority district from House Bill 1. It then adds an additional majority-minority district, District 6. To attain a majority black voting age population, the district connects black populations from Baton Rouge and Lafayette in the south-central region of the state with the black population in Shreveport in the far northwest of the state. Senate Bill 8 differed from the illustrative maps on which the district court relied in Robinson. These illustrative maps also include a second majority minority district, but one with very different boundaries. This district connects largely urban black communities in Baton Rouge and Lafayette with more rural black communities in the northeast corner of the state. By contrast, Senate Bill 8's District 6 connects the Baton Rouge and Lafayette black populations with the distant black population in Shreveport in the northwest. Louisiana adopted this scheme rather than the one used in the Robinson illustrative maps because it protects the Republican incumbents the state considered most important. The Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, the House Majority Leader, Steve Scalise, and an Appropriations Committee member, Julia Letlow. Not long after Senate Bill 8 was enacted, another lawsuit was filed, this time in the Western District of Louisiana. A group of plaintiffs, the Calais plaintiffs, asserted that Senate Bill 8, and specifically District 6, was a racial gerrymander that violated the Equal Protection Clause. The plaintiffs from Robinson intervened in the litigation, seeking to defend Louisiana's decision to draw a second majority-minority district. Because the Calais plaintiffs challenged the constitutionality of the apportionment of congressional districts, a district court of three judges was convened to hear the suit. 28 United States Code, Section 2284A. The court held a three-day preliminary injunction hearing, which was consolidated with a trial on the merits. Observing that Senate Bill 8's second majority minority district stretches some 250 miles from Shreveport in the northwest corner of the state to Baton Rouge in southeast Louisiana, slicing through metropolitan areas to scoop up pockets of predominantly black populations from Shreveport, Alexandria, Lafayette, and Baton Rouge, the court concluded that the map affected a racial gerrymander that violates the Equal Protection Clause. The state of Louisiana and the Robinson interveners appealed the decision directly to this court, and the court noted probable jurisdiction. After an initial round of briefing and argument last term, the court restored these cases to the calendar for re-argument this term. We ordered supplemental briefing on the following question: whether the state's intentional creation of a second majority-minority congressional district violates the 14th or 15th Amendments to the United States Constitution. And because the state's intentional creation of a second majority-minority district had been prompted by an order suggesting that such a district is required by the Voting Rights Act, our question necessarily implicated the correctness of our long-standing assumption that compliance with the Voting Rights Act may justify what the Constitution generally condemns, the use of race as a basis for government action. This question was pending in several lower court cases, but in light of the potential impact of those cases on upcoming elections, we concluded that resolution of the question in this suit was appropriate. In considering whether the Constitution permits the intentional use of race to comply with the Voting Rights Act, we start with the general rule that the Constitution almost never permits the federal government or a state to discriminate on the basis of race. Such discrimination triggers strict scrutiny, and our precedents have identified only two compelling interests that can satisfy that standard. One compelling interest, not relevant here, is avoiding imminent and serious risks to human safety in prisons, such as a race riot. See Johnson v. California, decided in 2005. The only other compelling interest we have found is remediating specific, identified instances of past discrimination that violated the Constitution or a statute. To rise to the level of a compelling state interest, an effort to remediate past discrimination must satisfy two conditions. First, the discrimination must be identified discrimination. In other words, the state or federal government must identify the specific instances of past discrimination that it aims to remediate and, in light of that specification, must determine the precise scope of the injury it seeks to remedy. The states and federal government have no compelling interest in generally remediating past discrimination in a particular industry or region or the effects of societal discrimination. Second, after identifying the specific instance of discrimination, the institution that makes the racial distinction must have a strong basis in evidence to conclude that its remedial action is necessary. Our acceptance of race-based state action has been rare for a reason. Distinctions between citizens solely because of their ancestry are by their very nature odious to a free people whose institutions are founded upon the doctrine of equality. And in redistricting, where the state assumes from a group of voters race that they think alike, share the same political interests, and will prefer the same candidates at the polls, it engages in racial stereotyping at odds with equal protection mandates. The question before us now is whether compliance with the Voting Rights Act should be added to our very short list of compelling interests that can justify racial discrimination. To answer that question, we must understand exactly what Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act demands with respect to the drawing of legislative districts. We therefore turn to the text of that provision. As amended in 1982, Section 2 states, "No voting qualification or prerequisite to voting or standard, practice, or procedure shall be imposed or applied by any state or political subdivision in a manner which results in a denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race or color, as provided in subsection B. Violation of subsection A is established if, based on the totality of circumstances, it is shown that the political processes leading to nomination or election in the state or political subdivision are not equally open to participation by members of a class of citizens protected by the subsection, in that its members have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. The extent to which members of a protected class have been elected to office in the state or political subdivision is one circumstance which may be considered, provided that nothing in this section establishes a right to have members of a protected class elected in numbers equal to their proportion in the population. 52 United States Code, Section 10301. This is not the easiest language to parse, and we will therefore break it down in steps. Beginning with subsection A, we take as given that a legislative districting map may constitute a standard, practice, or procedure. If that were not so, there would have been no statutory basis for any of our Section 2 vote dilution cases. See Holder v. Hall, decided in 1994. Therefore, subsection A means that a districting map may run afoul of Section 2 if it results in a denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race or color. With that established, subsection B explains when such a denial or abridgment occurs, when the political processes leading to nomination or election are not equally open to participation by members of a racial group of voters, in that they have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to elect representatives of their choice. In this complicated verbal formulation, the key concept for present purposes is less opportunity than other members of the electorate to elect representatives of their choice. This language sets a baseline against which to assess the opportunity of minority voters, the opportunity that other members of the electorate have to elect their preferred candidates. To understand this baseline, we must nail down the meaning of three terms: less opportunity, other members of the electorate, and elect. In isolation, opportunity could refer to either a desired outcome or a chance to achieve that outcome. As used in Section 2B, however, opportunity must mean a chance to achieve a desired result, because the Voting Rights Act does not guarantee equal outcomes. See White. Accordingly, less opportunity must mean a lesser chance. In ordinary usage, less opportunity often takes on such meaning. One might say, for example, that men under 6 feet tall have less opportunity to play in the NBA than those who stand at least 6 feet 7 inches, the current median. The next term, other members of the electorate, specifies the comparator to be used in determining whether the group protected by subsection A has suffered or is threatened with suffering less opportunity to elect representatives of their choice. In conceptualizing the members of this comparator group, we may think of a randomly selected member of the electorate who has particular voting preferences, or we may think of a randomly selected group of voters who share certain voting preferences. These voting preferences may be based on a candidate's party affiliation, ideology, stance on a particular policy issue, personal charisma, or some other characteristic or set of characteristics. But whatever they are, the situation of these randomly selected voters must be compared with that of minority voters alleged to have suffered vote dilution. This brings us to the final term, to elect. As used in Section 2B, this term must refer to the achievement of electoral victory by casting a ballot. Putting all these terms together, the baseline is the chance enjoyed by non-minority voters to secure the election of their preferred candidates. What, then, is the chance that any given non-minority voter or group of non-minority voters has to secure the election of a preferred candidate? The answer to this question depends on the voting preferences of other voters in the district. For example, in a district where most voters prefer Democratic candidates, a Republican voter in that district will have a low chance of securing the election of his or her preferred candidate. But that chance would be substantially higher if the district were instead filled with voters who prefer Republican candidates. The roster of voters who end up in a given district depends, in turn, on the districting criteria used by the state in drawing a legislative map. If a districting map is produced by computer, as is generally the case today, we may think of all the parameters in the algorithm that the mapmaker uses. One necessary parameter would be the number of districts required by law, and another would have to be a range of inter-district population variations that is small enough to comply with the one person, one vote requirement. The algorithm might then go on to lay out and assign priorities to whatever additional permissible criteria the legislature chooses to use. For example, the legislature might want to minimize changes in the prior map, avoid districts with discontiguous territory, and avoid splitting counties or municipalities. It might impose a certain standard of compactness, aim to protect some or all incumbents, or promote the prospects of a particular political party. When this algorithm is used, the map it produces may place a particular voter or group of voters in a district in which a majority generally agrees, generally disagrees, or only sometimes agrees with their voting preferences. But in any event, the opportunity of these members of the electorate to contribute their votes to a winning cause is whatever opportunity results from the application of the state's combination of permissible criteria. That is what our randomly selected individual voter and group of voters can expect regarding their opportunity to elect a preferred candidate. And under Section 2, a minority voter is entitled to nothing less and nothing more. Not only is this the best reading of the statutory text, but it also ensures that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act does not exceed Congress's authority under Section 2 of the 15th Amendment. That provision confers the power to enforce the amendment by appropriate legislation. Thus, to lie within Congress's authority, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act must effectuate by appropriate measures the constitutional prohibition in Section 1 of the 15th Amendment. Our 14th and 15th Amendment jurisprudence delineates what constitutes appropriate legislation in the sense relevant here. See City of Bourne v. Flores, decided in 1997, stating that Congress has parallel power to enforce the provisions of the 14th and 15th Amendments. In legislation enforcing these amendments, there must be a congruence and proportionality between the injury to be prevented or remedied and the means adopted to that end. As the Court has long held, the 15th Amendment bars only state action motivated by a discriminatory purpose. See Reno v. Bossier Parish School Board, decided in 1997. So a law that seeks to enforce the 15th Amendment by prohibiting mere disparate impact would fail to enforce a right that the amendment secures. That is never appropriate because Congress cannot enforce a constitutional right by changing what the right is. See City of Bourne. For this reason, the focus of Section 2 must be enforcement of the 15th Amendment's prohibition on intentional racial discrimination. When Section 2 is properly interpreted in the way we have outlined, it is sufficiently congruent with and proportional to the amendment's prohibition. While that interpretation does not demand a finding of intentional discrimination, it imposes liability only when the circumstances give rise to a strong inference that intentional discrimination occurred. Suppose, for example, that the application of a state's districting algorithm yields numerous maps with districts in which the members of a minority group constitute a majority, and suppose that the state cannot provide a legitimate reason for rejecting all those maps and eliminating all majority-minority districts. In such a situation, the inference of racial motivation is strong, and Section 2 of the 15th Amendment permits the imposition of liability without demanding that the courts engage in the fraught enterprise of attempting to determine whether the state legislature as an institution as opposed to certain individual members or the state's hired mapmaker, was motivated by race. Only when understood this way does Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act properly fit within Congress's 15th Amendment enforcement power. See, for example, INS v. St. Cyr, decided in 2001, if an otherwise acceptable construction of a statute would raise serious constitutional problems, and where an alternative interpretation of the statute is fairly possible, we are obligated to construe the statute to avoid such problems. By contrast, interpreting Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to outlaw a map solely because it fails to provide a sufficient number of majority-minority districts would create a right that the amendment does not protect. And such an interpretation would run headlong into the Act's express disclaimer against racial proportionality. Properly understood, Section 2 thus does not intrude on states' prerogative to draw districts based on non-racial factors. Redistricting constitutes a traditional domain of state legislative authority. The Constitution imposes some important restrictions on the state's exercise of this power, but they are otherwise free to draw districts as they please. We have held that they may use traditional districting factors such as compactness, contiguity, maintaining the integrity of political subdivisions, preserving the core of existing districts, and protecting incumbents. Nothing in the Constitution requires states to heed these criteria, of course, and the desirability of some of these criteria might be disputed. But because they are not forbidden by the Constitution, it is up to each state to decide what weight, if any, they warrant. The same is true with respect to the drawing of districts to achieve partisan advantage. Disapproval of partisan gerrymandering dates back to the founding. See Rusho v. Common Cause, decided in 2019. But partisan gerrymandering claims are not justiciable in federal court. Federal judges have no license to reallocate political power between the two major political parties with no plausible grant of authority in the Constitution and no legal standards to limit and direct their decisions. Thus, in considering the constitutionality of a districting scheme, courts must treat partisan advantage like any other race-neutral aim. A constitutionally permissible criterion that states may rely on as desired. For this reason, as we have repeatedly made clear, when a state defends a districting scheme on the ground that it was drawn for partisan purposes, plaintiffs have a special burden to overcome. To prevail, the plaintiff must disentangle race from politics by proving that the former drove a district's lines. That means, among other things, ruling out the competing explanation that political considerations dominated the legislature's redistricting efforts. If either politics or race could explain a district's contours, the plaintiff has not cleared its bar. See Easley v. Cromarty, decided in 2001, Cromarty 2, rejecting a racial gerrymandering claim when the plaintiffs failed to show that the legislature could have achieved its legitimate political objectives in alternative ways that are comparably consistent with traditional districting principles. A plaintiff may carry its disentanglement burden by offering an alternative map that achieves all the state's objectives, including partisan advantage and any of the state's other political goals, at least as well as the state's map. Today, Section 2 litigants almost always have the wherewithal to proffer such a map if there is one to be found. See Abbott v. League of United Latin American Citizens, 2025, holding that the lack of an alternative map merits a dispositive or near dispositive adverse inference against a racial gerrymandering plaintiff. See Alexander. Any plaintiff with a strong case has had every incentive to produce such an alternative map. See also Allen, observing that modern computer technology allows challengers to generate millions of possible districting maps for a given state. But if a Section 2 plaintiff cannot disentangle race from the state's race-neutral considerations, including politics, then Section 2 cannot impose liability. In short, Section 2 imposes liability only when the evidence supports a strong inference that the state intentionally drew its districts to afford minority voters less opportunity because of their race. Not only does this interpretation follow from the plain text of Section 2, but it is consistent with the limited authority that the 15th Amendment confers. This interpretation of Section 2 does not require abandonment of the Jingles framework. We need only update the framework so it aligns with the statutory text and reflects important developments since we decided Jingles 40 years ago. Four historical developments are of particular note. First, vast social change has occurred throughout the country, and particularly in the South, where many Section 2 suits arise. As this court has recognized, things have changed dramatically in the decades since the passage of the Voting Rights Act. At the time of the Act's passage, the nation had faced nearly a century of entrenched racial discrimination in voting, an insidious and pervasive evil which had been perpetuated in certain parts of our country through unremitting and ingenious defiance of the Constitution. But the Voting Rights Act led to great strides in the ensuing decades. Voting tests were abolished. Disparities in voter registration and turnout due to race were erased, and African Americans attained political office in record numbers. By 2004, the racial gap in voter registration and turnout had largely disappeared, with minorities registering and voting at levels that sometimes surpassed the majority. Black voters now participate in elections at similar rates as the rest of the electorate, even turning out at higher rates than white voters in two of the five most recent presidential elections nationwide and in Louisiana. Second, a full-blown two-party system has emerged in the states where Section 2 suits are most common. Jingles arose in the context of a one-party system in which black and white voters had starkly different voting patterns despite their affiliation within the same party. In the area involved in Jingles, an overwhelming majority of white voters did not vote for any black candidate in the Democratic Party primary elections, which for all practical purposes selected the candidates who would ultimately obtain office. And in general elections, white voters in heavily Democratic areas often ranked black candidates last among Democrats. Such intra-party disparities showed that black voters had less opportunity to elect their preferred candidate because of their race, not because of their partisan affiliation. When the vast majority of voters, regardless of race, favors the same political party, a map that is disadvantageous for members of one racial group cannot be explained on the ground that it was drawn to favor a particular political party. But in a state where both parties have substantial support and where race is often correlated with party preference, a litigant can easily exploit Section 2 for partisan purposes by repackaging a partisan gerrymandering claim as a racial gerrymandering claim. That brings us to the third significant post-Jingles development, this court's decision in Rucho. In that decision, we held that claims of partisan gerrymandering are not justiciable in federal court. The upshot of Rucho was that, as far as federal law is concerned, a state legislature may use partisan advantage as a factor in redistricting, and litigants cannot circumvent that rule by dressing their political gerrymandering claims in racial garb. Imposing liability based on the racial effects of a political gerrymander in a jurisdiction in which race and partisan preference are very closely correlated would, if accepted, provide a convenient way for future litigants and lower courts to sidestep our holding in Rucho that partisan gerrymandering claims are not justiciable in federal court. Instead of claiming that a state impermissibly set a target Republican and Democratic breakdown, a plaintiff could simply reverse engineer the partisan data into racial data and argue that the state impermissibly set a particular racial target. Our decisions cannot be evaded with such ease. The fourth significant development since Jingles is the increased use and capabilities of computers in drawing districts and creating illustrative maps. With modern computer technology at the ready, Section 2 plaintiffs invariably invoke the assistance of experts who can generate thousands or even millions of maps. Computer algorithms can easily control for partisan preferences and other redistricting factors such as compactness and county splits. With the advent of such technology, if it is possible to identify an alternative map that fully achieves all the state's legitimate goals while producing greater racial balance, then a Section 2 plaintiff can easily do so. In light of these significant developments, it is appropriate to update the Gingles framework and realign it with the text of Section 2 and constitutional principles. The first Gingles precondition is that a community of minority voters must. To satisfy this precondition, many Section 2 plaintiffs have simply provided illustrative maps with their desired number of majority-minority districts. Such maps, however, are not alone sufficient. They prove only that the state could create an additional majority-minority district, not that the state's failure to do so violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. To make the latter showing, plaintiffs' illustrative maps must satisfy two conditions. First, in drawing illustrative maps, plaintiffs cannot use race as a districting criterion. If a plaintiff can produce an additional majority-minority district only by using race, a process that would be unconstitutional if a state engaged in such map-making, that illustrative map sheds no light on whether the state acted unconstitutionally by not adopting such a map. Thus, an illustrative map in which race was used has no value in proving a Section 2 plaintiff's case. Second, illustrative maps must meet all the state's legitimate districting objectives, including traditional districting criteria and the state's specified political goals. If the state's aims in drawing a map include a target partisan distribution of voters, a specific margin of victory for certain incumbents, or any other goal not prohibited by the Constitution, the plaintiff's illustrative maps must achieve these goals just as well. If not, the plaintiffs would fail to demonstrate that the state's chosen map was driven by racial considerations rather than permissible aims. Only by meeting all the state's legitimate objectives can the illustrative maps help to disentangle race from politics and other constitutionally permissible considerations. To satisfy the second and third preconditions, politically cohesive voting by the minority and racial bloc voting by the majority, the plaintiffs must provide an analysis that controls for party affiliation. In other words, they must show that voters engage in racial bloc voting that cannot be explained by partisan affiliation. This is, once again, critical for disentangling race and politics. The facts of Gingles afford a good example of how a Section 2 plaintiff can properly meet these preconditions. There, as discussed, black and white voters had dramatically different voting patterns within the Democratic Party. This type of intra-party racial bloc voting pattern helps to demonstrate that the minority plaintiffs have less opportunity than their majority counterparts because of race, not just because of partisan affiliation. By contrast, simply pointing to inter-party racial polarization proves nothing, because a jurisdiction may engage in constitutional political gerrymandering, even if it so happens that the most loyal Democrats happen to be black Democrats, and even if the state were conscious of that fact. Last, the totality of circumstances inquiry must focus on evidence that has more than a remote bearing on what the 15th Amendment prohibits. Present-day intentional racial discrimination regarding voting. Discrimination that occurred some time ago, as well as present-day disparities that are characterized as the ongoing effects of societal discrimination, are entitled to much less weight. Far more germane are current data and current political conditions that shed light on current intentional discrimination. In large part because of the Voting Rights Act, Our nation has made great strides in eliminating racial discrimination in voting. And if, as a result of this progress, it is hard to find pertinent evidence relating to intentional present-day voting discrimination, that is cause for celebration. Nothing in Allen dictates a result that differs from the one we reach today. The decision in that case was based on the state of Alabama's specific argument that its race-neutral benchmark was necessary in any redistricting case. Alabama argued that deriving this benchmark, the median or average number of majority-minority districts in a race-blind multi-million map set, Allen, required computer simulations that are technically complicated, expensive to produce, and available to only a small cadre of university researchers that have the resources and expertise to run them. Nonetheless, the state contended that its race-neutral benchmark was the only plausible test to ensure that Section 2 stays within constitutional guardrails. We rejected that single-minded view. Allen, in short, was about whether Alabama's novel evidentiary standard required a change to our existing Section 2 precedent. It did not. Allen did not address the central issue here. We had no occasion in Allen to confront the presumption that compliance with Section 2 may serve as a compelling interest for a state to satisfy strict scrutiny. Indeed, Allen did not discuss the 14th Amendment at all. Here, by contrast, it is the linchpin of this suit. In addition, our decision in Allen did not reach two pivotal issues that we now squarely address. First, we left open whether race-based redistricting under Section 2, even if permissible when the Voting Rights Act was enacted in 1982, could extend indefinitely into the future despite significant changes in relevant conditions. See Shelby County requiring assessment of the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act in light of current conditions. Second, because the state in Allen did not cite partisan goals in defending its map, we did not address whether Section 2 plaintiffs must disentangle race from politics in proving their case. Indeed, this is our first occasion to address the implications of RUSHO in a vote dilution case. Failing to account for political considerations in redistricting, as explained above, can allow plaintiffs to undo a state's legitimate non-racial decisions under the banner of Section 2. In light of our answers to these questions left open in Allen, we now update the Jingles test to ensure a constitutional reading and application of Section 2. The dissent claims that the 14th Amendment is irrelevant to our analysis. But the dissent appears to forget, or at least tries to lead readers to forget, that the decision before us is based on the 14th Amendment. The plaintiffs claimed, and the court below held, that the map enacted by the state legislature in Senate Bill 8 impermissibly discriminated on the basis of race and thus violated the plaintiff's rights under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Under the updated Jingles framework, the facts of this suit easily require affirmation. Louisiana's enactment of Senate Bill 8 triggered strict scrutiny because the state's underlying goal was racial. The state never hid the ball. It configured District 6 to achieve a black voting age population over 50% because it knew that if it failed to do so, the Robinson Court would very likely find its map unlawful and order the use of something like the Robinson plaintiffs' illustrative maps, which would have imperiled one of the influential incumbents the legislature sought to protect. The state's intentional compliance with the court's demands constituted an express acknowledgement that race played a role in the drawing of district lines. Louisiana, therefore, had to satisfy the extraordinarily onerous standard of proving that its use of race was narrowly tailored to further a compelling governmental interest. No compelling interest justifies Senate Bill 8. Section 2 does not provide a compelling interest because the state did not need to create a new majority-minority district to comply with the act. That is because, at every step of the Jingles framework, the Robinson plaintiffs failed to prove their Section 2 case. On the first Jingles precondition, the Robinson plaintiffs did not meet their burden because they did not provide an illustrative map that met all the state's non-racial goals. The most obvious deficit in the plaintiffs' illustrative maps was the failure to meet the state's political goals, including incumbency protection. The plaintiffs' preferred map would have placed Representative Letlow in a majority Democratic district and thus effectively ensured her exit from Congress. See brief for appellant in number 24-109. Appendix to jurisdictional statement in number 24-101, p. 673a, placing Representative Letlow in a district with over twice as many registered Democrats as registered re-election. The Robinson court erroneously concluded that the plaintiffs' illustrative maps protected incumbents because the maps left all six representatives in the district where they currently live and could avoid incumbent pairing. That observation missed the point. An incumbent is not protected if he or she will lose re-election. And because the plaintiffs' illustrative maps failed to protect all the incumbents that the state sought to shield, the plaintiffs did not meet their burden on this precondition, nor did the plaintiffs meet their burden on the second and third Jingles preconditions. To show racially polarized voting, the Robinson plaintiffs offered evidence that black and white voters consistently supported different candidates, but their analysis did not control for partisan preferences. Even if the Robinson plaintiffs had met their burden on the Jingles preconditions, they still would have failed to show an objective likelihood of intentional discrimination based on the totality of circumstances. The Robinson court went through the 9 Senate report factors, but none of the evidence it cited showed even a plausible likelihood of intentional discrimination by the state. Much of the cited evidence, such as the low number of black Louisianans who have been elected to Congress in recent decades, failed to disentangle race from politics. Indeed, the court observed that black voters have been aligned with the Democratic Party for decades and that issues discussed by that party appealed to black voters. Those observations should have undercut, not strengthened, any showing of intentional racial discrimination because race and politics are so intertwined. The Robinson court also relied on the sordid histories of intentional discrimination by Louisianian officials in the decades before the Voting Rights Act's passage, and it cast aside as irrelevant the lack of evidence that black voters had faced intentional discrimination in recent years. That analysis had its priorities backwards. The 15th Amendment, which the Voting Rights Act enforces, is not designed to punish for the past, but works to ensure a better future. The focus of Section 2 must therefore be on current conditions, not on decades-old data relevant to decades-old problems. And none of the historical evidence presented by plaintiffs came close to showing an objective likelihood that the state's challenged map was the result of intentional racial discrimination. In sum, because the Voting Rights Act did not require Louisiana to create an additional majority-minority district, no compelling interest justified the state's use of race in creating Senate Bill 8. That map is an unconstitutional gerrymander, and its use would violate the plaintiffs' constitutional rights. The dissent's arguments are fully addressed in the prior sections of this opinion, but in closing, we emphasize 3 points. First, the dissent states over and over again that our decision requires a Section 2 plaintiff to prove discriminatory intent. What must be shown is exactly what the 1982 amendment of Section 2 called for. A Section 2 plaintiff in a vote dilution case must show that a districting scheme denies members of a racial group the same opportunity as other voters to elect the candidates they prefer. When that is shown, the circumstances are comparable to those in White, the decision from which the new language added by Congress in 1982 was drawn. That is, the circumstances must give rise to a strong inference of racial discrimination. Second, Contrary to the dissent's assertion, we have not overruled Allen. As is our general practice, the Allen court adjudicated the case based on the party's arguments, and in that case, the state did not defend its map on the ground that it was drawn to achieve a political objective. Here, the state has been forthright from the beginning that its aim was to protect the state's most prominent Republican House members. One may lament partisan gerrymandering, but for the reasons explained in Rucho, partisan gerrymandering claims are not justiciable in federal court. And in a racial gerrymandering case like the one before us, race and politics must be disentangled, as even the author of the dissent has acknowledged. See Cooper with the opinion of the court holding that a racial gerrymandering plaintiff must disentangle race from politics and prove that the former drove a district's lines. That is true regardless whether the case is brought pursuant to the 14th Amendment or the Voting Rights Act, since Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act requires evidence giving rise to a strong inference of intentional discrimination. If race and politics are not disentangled, and a Section 2 claim is cynically used as a tool for advancing a partisan end, the Voting Rights Act's noble goal will be perverted. Third, while the dissent wraps itself in the mantle of stare decisis, the dissent is unabashedly at war with key precedents. Claiming that Rucho was disastrously wrong and should be cabined, it is so repeatedly criticizing Shelby County and citing the dissent in that case. Criticizing the court's decision in Brnovich. Respect for precedent cannot be a one-way street. The judgment of the district court is affirmed, and these cases are remanded for proceedings consistent with this opinion. It is so ordered.